Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen. Our Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In an age characterized as a war on terror, we might think of terrorists as beyond our regard as human beings. Anyone who has murdered innocent civilians for some political or ideological cause surely must have crossed so far over to the dark side that they are essentially evil or insane. It's hard for us to think of a terrorist as a rational political actor or to give any credence at all to their cause. In today's climate, efforts to understand terrorists or their rationale may seem accommodating or naive, even unpatriotic. But if we are to defeat the terrorists, wouldn't it help to know all we can about them? During this hour, Focus 580, we'll talk with someone who has studied terrorism and terrorists since well before September 11, 2001. Louise Richardson is Executive Dean of the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study and Senior Lecturer in Government at Harvard University. She's also a lecturer in law at Harvard Law School. Louise Richardson is also author of the book What Terrorists Want, Understanding the Enemy, Containing the Threat, recently published by Random House. The book is a synthesis of her research into the nature of terrorism and terrorists and what this tells us about how to effectively contain the terrorist threat. We'll talk about that during this hour of Focus 580. As we talk with Louise Richardson, we invite you into the conversation. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and call us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. And Louise Richardson joins us this morning at Harvard University via ISDN, a very high-quality connection, and also thanks to Evan Whitney at Harvard for that. Dean Richardson, good morning. Do we have a guest there?
Yes, okay. We do.
Thank you so much. Sorry about that, a little glitch. Okay, just to get started here, what drew you to the study of terrorists and terrorist movements in the first place?
Well, in the first place, I grew up in rural Ireland at a time when Northern Ireland was exploding. So I grew up in an environment which was very sympathetic to the terrorism of the IRA. The IRA was just seen as a continuation of the historical and entirely legitimate conflict between Ireland and Britain. So I grew up with a vision of Irish history that, in which Britain was the enemy, Britain subjugated Ireland, and the Ireland was weak and suffered unfairly at Britain's hands. So I observed people actually join the IRA, friends, teachers, neighbors. But I had the good fortune of going to college in Dublin, and I went to Trinity College, which is actually a Protestant university, or was at the time. So I learned an entirely different version of Irish history. So I became fascinated by how two different sets of people could have utterly opposing interpretations of the same event. I subsequently came to America to get my PhD and started reading the literature on terrorism and saw terrorists depicted as one-dimensional bad guys, as monsters. And I felt this was really quite wrong, that in fact the reality is many people join terrorist groups who in other parts of their lives conduct exemplary lives. Young idealists, caring parents, upstanding members of the community. What they share is a fanatical commitment to a cause, but they're willing to sacrifice themselves for that cause. So really, I've dedicated my professional life to trying to understand how it is that people who in some parts of their lives exercise the same morals as you and I, and yet commit extraordinary atrocities that are so completely, to use your term, beyond the pale.
I take it this was, before 9/11, somewhat of a lonely field, even though it was a subject of increasing focus. It was not a subject of real academic study for the most part.
Oh, not at all. I mean, very few universities in the country offered courses on terrorism. Most of us who taught terrorism also taught other courses, too, because really the field of terrorism wasn't seen as a legitimate course of study. I would say that this feeling was not felt by students. Students were fascinated. I've always been delighted by the extent of the student interest in the subject, but it was not shared in the academic community, no.
That's interesting. And is still in some ways undervalued, you say, by the U.S. government, at least in the sense of really understanding the movements.
Well, yes, I think we the government has tended to see this as a military problem and thus far really hasn't been willing to take advantage of the years of research that has been done into the range of movements. And I think had our policy after 9/11 been influenced more by the people who really understood this subject and had worked in it for many years, I actually think we would have pursued a different policy.
Well, we'll talk more about that, to be sure, during this hour. But I wanted to ask you, how do you go about studying terrorists and terrorist movements? You've actually interacted with people who, you know, might be, I'm not sure they are people who have committed acts of terror. I wasn't sure from your writing, you know, who these people were, but you actually organized academic conferences with people from their movements.
That's right. I mean, I would say working in this field is utterly different post 9/11 than it was prior to 9/11. Prior to 9/11, it was not difficult to make contacts with members of terrorist groups, to meet with them, to interview them. It was also the case that terrorist groups used the web a lot. And certainly when I used to teach in the 1990s, I used to require my students to follow the websites of terrorist groups. The problem now is in 1997, 98, there were about 12 terrorist websites. Now there's upwards of 4,000, so it's very difficult to keep track of all of them. But again, prior to 9/11, so long as people could be assured that their security was not being compromised, they were perfectly willing to meet and to talk to academics or indeed journalists. They believe in the legitimacy of their cause, and they were certainly willing to take the opportunity to try and justify their actions and make their case.
Well, let's sort of address head-on this notion that terrorists are insane, immoral, irrational actors, that they are somehow some other category of human being. And what would you say about that?
Well, I'm afraid there are no other categories of human beings. We are what we are. And much as it would be nice to think that there was a category of monsters, the reality is there isn't. And human beings are capable of good, and they're capable of doing very bad things too. Most human beings, and I think this is true of terrorists, do not believe that they are doing bad things. They consider what they're doing as legitimate. And most terrorists have in their speeches and in their writings, both for external and internal consumption, go to great pains to justify their actions. So they will justify something like 9/11 on the grounds that, well, the West has committed worse atrocities to them, against them, or on the grounds that, well, there are no civilians in America because, after all, we vote for our government and therefore we're responsible for it, on the grounds that there are no other options available to them. Now, I believe all these arguments are quite spurious, but the fact is they believe in the legitimacy of what they're doing. I have never met a terrorist who did not think what he or she was doing was entirely justified.
Well, and we see this in the stories of the people who have, you know, even the some of the hijackers on 9/11, some of them seemed such normal, even middle class, even, you know, affluent people who had so much to live for that, you know, you'd think of them as maybe even nice people.
I think many people did consider them nice people. And again, you saw this perhaps even more clearly in the case of the four men who blew up the London Underground last July. Their friends, their neighbors were completely stunned. Indeed, their families were stunned to learn that they had done this. The leader of this group is a 30-year-old man who was a teacher of the handicapped. He was the children adored him. He was famously kind, looked after the most troubled kids. And yet this was somebody who led a group of three young men to attack the London Underground, and they ended up killing 56 people, including themselves. So the fact is, as he said in his video that was posthumously shown, he was radicalized by the war in Iraq, and he tried to justify his actions on the grounds of a just war, and that he was visiting on the West what the West had visited on his people. Now, how he came to identify with Muslims across the world and not the people with whom he lived and worked is really the interesting story here, I think.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think we're still confused about is the definition of terrorism itself. It seems the term is still very much contested or, you know, fuzzy, and perhaps part of our difficulty in addressing violent political conflicts is our use or misuse or misunderstanding of this word terrorism. And I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yes, I think that's exactly right, Jack. I think this term is used much too loosely. We simply pin it on people we disagree with. The only universally accepted attribute of the term terrorism is that it's pejorative. It's something the bad guys do. And so, of course, terrorists, when they when it's put to them that they are a terrorist, they will say, oh, well, you know, America is a much bigger terrorist, or so-and-so is a much bigger terrorist. Or if you define terrorist as being somebody who fights for a legitimate cause, then, of course, we're a terrorist. Now, my argument is that we actually should move towards a more normatively neutral notion or definition of the term terrorism. And in my view, a terrorist is, in its simplest form, somebody who deliberately targets noncombatants for political effect, so that it isn't the goals that they're trying to seek, but the means that they use to achieve these goals that determines whether or not a group is a terrorist group. And I would argue that unless and until we're willing to label a group whose goals we consider legitimate, but who deliberately target civilians to achieve those goals as a terrorist group, we're not going to make progress in countering terrorism. I mean, the international community for the past 30 or 40 years has been hamstrung on this very issue, because nobody wanted to pin the label terrorist on a group whose goals they considered legitimate. I mean, a classic case would be the Reagan administration in this country considered the Contras, in the words of President Reagan, the moral equivalent of the Founding Fathers, whereas our allies considered them terrorists. Again, if we just looked at the means a group used and not whether the goal they're seeking is legitimate or not, I think we could make a lot of progress. But we would have to be willing to label a group with goals we shared, a terrorist group, if they deliberately targeted civilians to achieve those goals.
So essentially, you're saying terrorism is political, that there is a political objective, and it's not just a matter of somebody being a monster and committing horrible acts. There is a essential goal that is the act is predicated upon.
Absolutely. I think unless it's politically inspired, it's not terrorism. In the book, I go through this 7-part definition that I was going to try and spare your readers, but I'll be very brief, or your listeners, I beg your pardon.
Sure.
The first, it's political. If it's not political, then it's a crime, but it's not a terrorist crime. It's violent. It's symbolic. You know, terrorists are invariably both outmanned and outgunned by their opponents, so they use symbolic targets to enhance the significance of their act. Fourthly, the point of terrorism is to communicate a message. It's not violence for the sake of it, or even violence in the expectation of defeating the enemy, but rather violence to communicate a political message. Fifth, and this is a very controversial point, and I don't doubt some of your listeners will disagree with me, I believe that terrorists are sub-state groups, that it's simply not helpful to label states terrorists. There's no doubt in my mind that states can and have committed acts that are the moral equivalent of terrorism. But if we want to have any analytical clarity in how we understand this concept, it seems to me we ought to limit it to non-state actors. The sixth point is that the victim of the terrorist and the audience they're trying to influence is not the same. And that's quite unusual. I mean, for most people who kill someone, they care whether they kill you or kill me, mm-hmm. but not for terrorists, because it's not the individual victims that they care about. It's the audience that they're trying to influence. And the final point, and it's the most important one, is the one I've mentioned, the deliberate targeting of noncombatants, not as an unintended side effect, but as deliberate strategy. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, if we kept firmly to this means-based definition of terrorism, we might be able to fashion more effective international cooperation against it.
We're talking this morning during this hour, Focus 580, with Louise Richardson. She's Executive Dean of the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study and Senior Lecturer in Government at Harvard University. She's a political scientist by training, and her academic focus has been on international security with an emphasis on terrorist movements. Her other books include The Roots of Terrorism, Democracy and Counterterrorism, Lessons from the Past, and When Allies Differ. And she's also author of the book we're discussing during this hour, entitled What Terrorists Want, Understanding the Enemy Containing the Threat. If you would like to join us, you are welcome to do so around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere else you can hear us, 800-222-9455. You want to dive into some of the stuff relating to 9/11 and our reaction to it. You write that when the history of the immediate 9/11 years comes to be written, it will be seen as a period marked by two major mistakes and two major missed opportunities. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yes. The two mistakes, I believe, were first and foremost the decision to declare war against terrorism. I think this is exactly what terrorists wanted us to do. It played into their hands. It elevated their stature. It immediately led people to think about, A, deploying the military, but B, victory and defeat. And if we've learned anything in the past 5 years, it's that it's very difficult to declare victory in a war on terrorism. The fact is, terrorism is a tactic, so it makes no more sense to declare war on a tactic, on the tactic of terrorism, than on any other tactic, like precision-guided bombing or what have you. So by declaring, by the most powerful country in the world, indeed in the history of the world, declaring war on a group of men living in caves under the sponsorship of one of the poorest governments on the planet seems to me to have elevated their stature to a degree to which they could only have dreamt. I mean, they're not a worthy opponent of ours. So declaring war on them, I think, was conceding exactly what they wanted. And in my view, the point of a war is to deny your adversary the objectives he's seeking. Mm-hmm. And the second mistake, I believe, was the conflation of the threat from Saddam Hussein with the threat from Osama bin Laden. These were both adversaries of ours, no doubt about it, but there was no connection between them. Any effort to have done a little bit of research into these two men would have realized they loathed one another, that Saddam Hussein represented exactly the kind of corrupt secular leader that bin Laden was determined to overthrow. So to have conflated those issues, I think, was a calamitous mistake. I mean, reasonable people can differ on the rights and wrongs of the war in Iraq, mm-hmm. but from a counterterrorism point of view, I believe it to have been an awful mistake. And then I argue that we missed two major opportunities. The first of these was the opportunity to mobilize the international community behind us. If you remember, this time 5 years ago, the entire world was shocked by this atrocity. They declared it to be a war against humanity, not just a war against us. We had NATO at the time just anxious to be used as the vanguard against terrorism. And yet we were so convinced of the uniqueness of this threat and the uniqueness of our position that we didn't take the time to mobilize, to take advantage of the mobilized world. And we simply headed off on our own to counter this threat. And finally, I think we missed an opportunity to educate the American public about the nature of terrorism, about the extent of the threat that it poses, that it really is a psychological game where the whole point is to frighten us more than their ability to actually harm us, and also to educate us about the realities of our strength and how that is perceived in other countries, and the fact that as the most powerful country in the world, there is no doubt that our wealth and our strength will be resented. It doesn't necessarily mean that we will develop enemies around the world, but it does mean that the purity of our motives that we consider self-evident is not as self-evident to those at the receiving end of those policies.
You see, there were many statements at the time after 9/11. You know, I think everyone sort of intrinsically or instinctively felt that this was a major paradigm shift, and after 9/11. Everything changed, I think, is the way that things have been said. You say that's an overreaction.
Yes, I think it is. You know, almost 3,000 people died. That was, each one of those was an appalling atrocity that should never have happened. But we are a country of 300 million people, and I think we need to keep our perspective. I would point out that within 6 months of our invasion of Afghanistan, more than 3,000 Afghan civilians were killed. I would also point that out, that which is not for a second to belittle the ghastly atrocity or the pain of those who suffered in it, but six times as many people are killed by drunk drivers every single year on America's roads than were killed on September 11th. Six times as many people every single year, and yet we don't turn our policy on its head. We don't ban alcohol. We don't have mandatory alcohol testing before you get on a freeway or outside pubs or bars at night. It seems to me we did indeed overreact to the threat that we faced. And I think, again, this in the sense the terrorists were extremely successful in what they were trying to achieve. So I think a much more modest response, a more thoughtful one, and one that was prepared to respond a little more slowly would ultimately have been a more successful one.
We have a couple calls to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. We'll go first to someone in Champaign County on line number one. Good morning.
Hi. That wasn't what I was going to call about, but you have to look then why the U.S. Bush administration chooses to respond in this fashion, it serves their interests too. And it seems that that's a long discussion, maybe not centrally on terror, but actually the U.S. has been involved in state terror for quite a while. I can go back to the World Court decision against the U.S. A lot of people don't realize that the attack on Nicaragua was adjudicated in the World Court, and some billions of dollars were fined against the U.S. Because we were supporting people who were attacking, quote, soft targets. This was political use of violence against civilians, or the use of violence. It seems more needs to be said about that as well. I wanted to ask you to react to, since Clash of Civilization is sort of the motif now of talking about terror, there's a fellow in University of Chicago, Thomas Papp, whose work I'm sure you're familiar with, I'd like you to comment on, which is the idea that he analyzed all of the suicide terrorists that were involved in Lebanon to push the Israelis out, help push. There were a lot of other strategies as well, I guess. But and he found that a minority of them were religiously motivated, that many of them were secular. I think one of them was a Maronite. I'd like to react to that too, because we're hearing that it's a religious fanaticism that we're fighting entirely, and I think this we need to disaggregate the motives. Some of them are overlapping, of course, but I'll listen. Thanks.
Thank you. You've raised several important points there on the clash of civilization, which is the theory coined by Sam Huntington. I would simply point out that some of the most this notion is extremely popular amongst the terrorists themselves, because it actually elevates their stature. They want to see this as a clash of civilization, and they love this term and use it all the time. And as to Robert Pape's book, this is a study of suicide terrorism, and your caller is quite right. His argument is that it's actually occupation, a response to occupation more than anything else, that drives decisions to commit suicide terrorism. I think Pape is quite right that this is not necessarily a religious issue. I think the whole the relationship between religion and terrorism is a fascinating one, to which I give a great deal of attention in the book, and something I've thought a lot about. I think religion plays different roles in different terrorist groups. For some, it's simply a badge of identity, a means of identifying who's the enemy, who's a friend. I mean, a classic case here would be something like the IRA. This isn't a religious conflict, but religion helps make the problem more intractable. By far the most common role I think religion plays is as a tool, a means of recruitment, as a tool in the hands of the leaders who use terrorism to use religion to cloak themselves in legitimacy. And only in the third case, and only very few cases, is this the case that religion actually determines what the terrorist group should do, actually tells them what they think they should do. In my work, I believe that a terrorist group needs is made up of three things. First, it's a disaffected individual. Second, it's a complicit community. And third, it's a legitimizing ideology. Now, sometimes that ideology is religious, but it doesn't need to be. And certainly cases like the Tamil Tigers, who until the war in Iraq had committed more suicide attacks than anybody else and are entirely secular, demonstrate that you don't need to be religious to be a terrorist, or indeed to be a suicide terrorist. And certainly if you take the broader sweep, both beyond our current experience of terrorism, both historically and geographically, you find that a great many terrorist groups were in fact secular or atheists. And those that were religious, there have been Jewish terrorist groups, Hindi terrorist groups, Muslim terrorist groups, you name it. Every religion or most religions have managed to produce a terrorist group at one point or another. So the notion that terrorism is somehow specifically linked to Islam, I think, is false. And indeed, the notion that one religion as a necessary component of terrorism, I think, is also false. So I would agree with your caller on all those points.
Hope that gets the caller's points. We're a little past our mid point here in this hour, Focus 580, our guest, Louise Richardson, Executive Dean of the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University, also Senior Lecturer in Government at Harvard University and Lecturer in Law at Harvard Law School, author of the book we're discussing, What Terrorists Want, Understanding the Enemy Containing the Threat, published by Random House. We have several callers waiting, and we will continue to speak with them. Next up, someone in Farina on line number 4. Good morning.
Hi. I appreciate your topic and your study of this. I think the Bush administration has played into the hands of the terrorists by, like you said, raising their status. And they've done a cynical thing to the American people and the world at large by using this term war on terror. What do you declare war on fear? I mean, when does the war on fear end? Another point, and I don't know, it just seems cynical, and it, like the previous caller said, it gives the people like the Bush administration the leverage to oppress the American people themselves and by extension the rest of the world by these draconian things like the rendition, and that leads to the next thing. They've actually broken the law of the Constitution that they're sworn to uphold, and I think that real crimes have been committed by this administration, actual crimes. And would you comment on that? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. On your first point, I would say, as you've probably picked up, I disagree entirely with the counterterrorism policy of the Bush administration over the past 5 years. But in defense of the Bush administration, I would say that they responded much like other democracies in similar circumstances have done. Once you have an attack by a terrorist group, there is enormous pressure on the government to do something, to act fast. Governments invariably overreact. It's part of the genius of terrorism that they can predictably provoke governments into overreacting. Governments invariably produce fairly draconian legislation, which rarely works, but has the full support of the public, which has been frightened. So, I'm perfectly prepared to concede the Bush administration acted in what they believed to be the best interests. I wish they had acted differently. As to their policies and what they have done since then, or if I could make one other point on that, I would say that the contrast with Prime Minister Tony Blair, and, you know, it's not easy for an Irish person to praise a British prime minister, given my background. But I have to say, listening to Tony Blair on the morning of July 7th, very early on, he was up in Scotland and he gave some unscripted comments on the bombing in London. And as I was listening to him, I thought, this is exactly how a democratic leader ought to respond to a terrorist attack. Now, he's had a lot of experience in countering terrorism, but he didn't escalate the rhetoric. He didn't get into this dialogue of the deaf where we're claiming to be victims to their aggression and they're claiming to be victim of our aggression. He simply and quietly talked about crime scenes and the police and this crime that would be investigated. And he talked about just the quiet determination of the British people to defend their own values being stronger than the adversary's desire to destroy them. So I think he did demonstrate a very different way of responding. But Mr. Bush, or the Bush administration's way, was certainly not unprecedented. Other governments have tended to react in the same way. Now, going to your second point about, and I agree with the caller that I think the Bush administration has gone way too far in using the war analogy, if you like, to justify practices which are simply not worthy of America's democracy. And I articulate at the end of this book a set of principles that I think should guide our policy. And a crucial one of these is, in fact, to live by our principles, both because that is, after all, the whole point. That is what we're defending. If we start ignoring the civil liberties of our citizens or indeed non-citizens, one quickly becomes to wonder what is it we are in fact defending. But on more pragmatic grounds, I would say it ultimately hurts us more than it helps us to engage in torture or rendition. I mean, as I say, in my view, no democracy worthy of the name engages in torture. But even pragmatically, I argue that it undermines our cause. I mean, can you imagine the damage that has been done to us and our moral authority in the world and our ability to mobilize support in the world by those pictures that have been shown around the world of our abuse of prisoners in Abu Ghraib has done incalculable damage to us. Who knows how many young people have been radicalized, how many people have been persuaded that we simply do not value Muslim lives, or that what our adversaries say about us is true. It seems to me that we can never prevail in this conflict unless and until our actions are consistent with our rhetoric, that our actions are seen to be consistent with the principles we espouse. Because ultimately, the people we have to persuade and have to win over are the moderate populations, the populations throughout the Middle East, not the members of Al-Qaeda. We will never persuade them. But the communities from which they derive their support, if they remain small and isolated, there's a real limit to the damage they can do to us. They will be spending most of their time worried about their own security, unable to coordinate in a sophisticated way enough to pull off a major attack. But if they can operate within a community which is complicit in their actions, because the community is convinced of their interpretation of our actions, and if it goes even further than that and they can generate mass-based support, then we're going to face a much graver threat than we currently do. So I would say, both for pragmatic as well as principled grounds, we should not engage in any practices that are not consistent with our standards of justice. And certainly the point of having judicial oversight of the executive seems to me to be a basic principle there.
We have several callers waiting. Let's go on and talk with another Urbana caller, line number one. Good morning.
Yeah, I wanted to hear more about why you thought terrorism should be limited to non-nations, which seems pretty counterproductive to me. I mean, even recently in The Observer, and I know this has been going on for a long time, but I only pick up stories like this once in a while, and that's that they were talking about how the police and your secret organizations in the UK were collaborating on some of the bombings, the IRA bombings, and apparently that's caused a uproar up there in the UK. And but if you limit it to non-nations, I mean, aren't you essentially giving a carte blanche to countries to go ahead and use terrorism whenever they can? I want to ask another question before you address that, and that is that, and I got to hang up, and that is that I had never watched this program called 24, but I've been picking it up on reruns, and I'm surprised how torture is really rampant in this TV show, and it makes me wonder, isn't torture just terrorism on a small scale, and isn't our willingness to use torture to get information really showing ourselves to be, soulmates of those people who use torture in the Middle East, for example? And I'll hang on. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. On the question of state terror, I don't believe for a second that I'm giving any government a carte blanche. I would simply say that we have international laws to adjudicate the behavior of states. We also have domestic laws to adjudicate the behavior of states. The previous caller pointed out that many of the actions of the government, of our government, constitute crimes. Well, I don't doubt that our judicial process will investigate these and determine whether or not, in fact, that is the case. So to restrict the notion of terrorism to the behavior of non-state actors is not to suggest that states have a carte blanche. It's not to suggest that states don't commit acts that are the moral equivalent of terrorism, nor is it to suggest that states don't use terrorism as an instrument of either their foreign policy or their counterterrorism policy. I concede all of that. I'm simply saying that if we want to have analytical clarity, we can't simply label terrorism, every behavior we dislike, terrorism. And it seems to me that there is generations of work by political scientists and international lawyers that can adjudicate the behavior of states and hold states accountable. I find it simply unhelpful to call the misbehavior of a state or the illegal behavior of a state terrorism in the same way that we use it for a sub-state group. On the question of torture, my response to all these kinds of questions is the same. Anytime we consider a counter-terrorist action, we should ask ourselves two questions. A, does it work? And B, at what cost? On the question of torture, it seems to me the evidence is actually mixed on whether it works. In some instances, it does. In a great many instances, it doesn't. I'm a social scientist. It seems to me there's a lot of information out there on terrorism on torture throughout the ages. We should look and see what the evidence suggests. So I will concede that the evidence is mixed on the first point. On the second point is at what cost? Now, in my view, as I said, the cost of our use of torture is simply way too high. A democracy should not ever engage in torture, period. And when we do, we undermine our moral position. We fudge the distinction between us and our adversaries. And again, pragmatically, once it becomes known that we're torturing, we make it so much harder to persuade the moderates of the world, the people we need to persuade, that we are, in fact, the good guys.
Just a quick follow-up on that last point. It seemed you were speaking of missed opportunities earlier in our discussion. And this thing about our attitude toward torture, there's still a debate going on between the White House and the Senate with regard to the latitude the CIA wants in interrogations. And speaking of missed opportunities, it seems like we could state very clearly for the record, for the world, that America stands against this. That we will not.
I agree. I wish we could. I wish we would. I think we should.
Okay. Well, we'll continue and talk with some listeners. Next up, someone in Indiana, line number two. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
I agree with everything you've said, but a number of times when I've heard people talk about the tragedy 9/11, they bring in this partial fact, I'll call it, approximately 3,000 to 4,000 people were killed, then immediately go into, the deaths on the highways and stuff like that, and we don't react that way. This is just a simple thing. It's the number of people were killed at one time. That's the psychological thing that allows these kinds of things to be kept going for a long time on TV. It's like if a school bus full of 20 children were killed all at one time. We don't start talking about how many kids were killed, per 100,000 miles of school bus driving, which would be quite low. It's just a simple thing, but sometimes those logical niceties end up later on doing things to your conclusions. So I just wanted to mention that. Thanks a lot, and excellent work. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
I think you're making a fair point, and I think you're quite correct. Of course, the fact that so many casualties at one time is part of what made this so dramatic, the fact that it happened on our own soil, and also the fact that it made such extraordinary television. I mean, terrorists have always preferred bombs, partly because it's easy to escape and get away, but also because they make good, great visuals. Terrorists have to rely on the world's media to spread the word for them, to spread word of their actions. And this was, who among us who was alive at the time can ever forget the power of the visual images we saw. So there are many reasons, of course, why this had such a profound impact. And I take your point that so many people dying at one time was part of them. Jack, could I be rude? There's one question I've been expecting to be asked and I haven't asked.
Absolutely. Please go ahead and address that then. That's fine.
Well, the title of the book is What Terrorists Want. And I would like to chance to answer that question if I could.
Absolutely.
And I'm worried that nobody's going to ask me.
Okay. Well, consider it asked.
Thank you. there's a lot of debate about whether, you know, whether or not terrorism works. And I think we can't answer that sensibly until you know what it is terrorists are looking for. Mm-hmm. And I think of this in terms of both terrorists having what I call primary and secondary motives. And the primary motives differ with the type of group. You know, some groups, nationalist groups, have want secession or independence. Religious groups want to replace secular law with religious groups. You know, Maoist groups want to bring about proletarian revolution, and so on. So the primary objectives differ with the different terrorist groups. But all terrorists across all these groups have what I call these more immediate or secondary motives. And these are, first and foremost, the desire for revenge. When you talk to terrorists, when you read their literature, by far and away the most powerful motivator, both for individuals and organizations, is the desire to avenge what they perceive are atrocities committed against them. So the first is revenge. The second is renown or glory. Terrorists want to be significant. I mean, we've seen this in the past couple of weeks with both bin Laden and his number two, al-Zawahiri, issuing these tapes and that then dominate our airwaves. They want to be players. And by becoming public enemy number one, they become significant. And this is true both of the leaders, but also of the young volunteers to become suicide terrorists. I mean, if you live in Gaza and you don't look like Britney Spears or play soccer like Zidane, you're not going to be a superstar unless you volunteer to be a martyr, and then you become a superstar. And the third thing they're looking for, the third thing terrorists want is they want a reaction. They want preferably an overreaction. They're deliberately trying to provoke us into a reaction because terrorists are, they don't have land, they all they have is their action. So they demonstrate that they're alive by acting and by provoking us into reacting to them. So I think the argument I make in this book is that what terrorists want are, you know, at the risk of oversimplifying for the sake of alliteration, the three R's, revenge, renown, and reaction. And if you believe that, as I do, then you really see that declaring a war on them is playing into their hands, because it is giving them more opportunity for vengeance. It is obviously almost by definition reacting, and it certainly is glorifying them by elevating their stature to be the enemy of the most powerful country in the world. So well, thank you for giving me a chance to make that point.
Thank you for interjecting that, because it is a very important point that you make in the book. So that's great. We do have several callers, and we're not going to probably get to everyone, because I also want to make sure that we talk about your suggestions for containing terrorism, and hopefully we'll get to that as well. But we have about 10 minutes left, so we'll try to squeeze in a couple more calls at least. Next up, someone in Urbana, line number 3. Good morning.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I would like to, I suppose, make a point and ask a question. It seems to me that the attack on the Twin Towers, the bin Laden episode, is rather atypical. It's simply not, it's simply an exception to the rule in terrorist acts, in that it was not directed against the primary target of bin Laden, which would be the progressive and also the rather corrupt and repressive regimes in the Middle East and throughout the Islamic world. His view, of course, is that of a Wahhabi, of a much less liberal form of Islam. And in that respect, the attack on the Twin Towers, as you have hinted, I think, was largely to draw us into a war against him, which would allow him to pose as the defender of Islam against the crusading Westerners. Would you agree with that?
Thank you. One of the things which is almost embarrassing, or indeed embarrassing for somebody like me to admit, is that I honestly don't think we know what was in his head. There's two schools of thought on this. One is that he thought we were so decadent and so corrupt that we were, as he repeatedly said, a paper tiger, that we wouldn't respond at all. And the second view is that he thought we would respond by waging war on Islam, and precisely the suggestion you make. My hunch is that he actually didn't know which reaction he would elicit, and he actually didn't mind too much because he won either way. So either he demonstrated that we were the paper tiger and he could claim victory by hurting us, or indeed he was provoking us into a war with Islam, which would then enable him, as you say, to pose as the defender of Islam against the West. As to the antipathy towards the moderate or more moderate leadership, there have been real divisions within al-Qaeda, or there were right after the Afghan war, and with two schools of thought, one being, well, now we've defeated one superpower, let's go after the other one, who really is the basis of the problem because he's the one who props up all these people like the House of Saud or Mubarak in Egypt and so on. And the others who felt, no, it's time to go back now back to Egypt, go back to Saudi Arabia and fight the good fight there and change the regimes there. So I think sometimes when we're faced with an enemy, certainly one as implacable as al-Qaeda, we tend to assume that they're a unified actor and that they have all their motives neatly lined up in a row. And often I think they're no more unified than we are on this point.
Very interesting. We have just about 5 minutes left, and I want to make sure that we talk about your suggestions in terms of a strategy for containing terrorism. You articulate 6 rules for counteracting terrorism, and maybe we can kind of at least touch on these things, because let's maybe end on a note of hope that there is an effective way to deal with the problem.
Well, I do, as you say, outline 6 principles that should guide our action, so I'll speed through them very quickly. And I would say that my mind actually is a message of hope, because I think if we have, and my first point is to have a defensible and achievable goal, and if we stop aspiring to eliminate terrorism, which is something we can never achieve, and instead have a much more modest goal of containing the threat from terrorism, that I think we can achieve. The second point is one that's been raised by several of your callers, and that is living by our principles. It seems to me it is imperative we do so, both so that we always know why it is, what it is we're defending, and second, for pragmatic grounds, because we want to make sure the rest of the world knows that we are indeed the good guys. The third point is to know your enemy. And here, there's simply no substitute for good intelligence. It seems to me if young Americans like John Walker Lynn or Jose Padilla can be out joining al-Qaeda and the like, then we should have our intelligence operatives in all of these movements. And I think we saw recently where the recent threat in London was exposed precisely because of a member of the intelligence services who had infiltrated one of these cells. If you look again at the counterterrorism experience of other countries, you see, for example, in Peru, a 70-man intelligence unit in the police force was able to do what tens of thousands of military could not. They studied the movement. They understood its weakness, which was its reliance on this one very charismatic leader. And through old-fashioned police work, they tracked him down. Knowing your enemy, you know, I think that it explains British success in Northern Ireland as well. And one simply cannot overestimate the importance of good intelligence. The fourth point is to again, I've alluded to this obliquely several times, the importance of separating the terrorists from the communities from which they derive support. This is something where we have a very strong hand if we'd only play it, and that is to make our case to the moderate Muslim world. But to do that, we need our actions to be consistent with our principles and our rhetoric, but we need to be out there buying up TV stations, buying up radio programs, and making our case. Now, I absolutely concede that given the extraordinary unpopularity of the war in Iraq, no effort to persuade is going to be successful until we manage to effect a reasonable resolution of this problem, because people are not going to be persuaded of our altruism as long as they perceive us having what they consider to be an army of occupation in the Middle East. Fifth point is to engage others in solving this problem with you, both the international community and moderate Muslims. They are the ones who can most effectively repudiate the extremists in their midst. Now, we don't need to have moderate Muslims as Americanophiles agreeing with everything we do or defending our actions. Nothing will minimize or undermine their legitimacy more quickly. We should see their criticism of us, I think, as success rather than failure. We respect people's right to criticize us, but engage them in solving this problem with us. And again, as we've seen through our success in controlling financial flows and in sharing intelligence, having the support of the international community is crucial. And the final point is to be patient and to keep our perspective and remember that we are infinitely stronger than they are. We have the resources with which to prevail in this conflict. They do not. And ultimately, to realize that there is no quick fix. There are no simple solutions. But ultimately, to bear in mind that our democracy, they cannot derail our democracy. We can only derail our democracy if we conclude it's inadequate to defend us.
Very interesting. Well, and again, on the subject of hope, we didn't exactly follow these rules, as you note in the book, initially and in the years succeeding or following 9/11. But you say that American counterterrorism policy is clearly improving.
I believe so. And again, I think this is a pattern we've seen in other cases. A country's counterterrorism policy improves with time. Almost invariably, they go through the same kind of process we've been going through, where the initial response is very draconian, very hard line. This is good versus evil. The public supports whatever measures the government wants. Then, as these measures don't bear fruit, you have a period of polarization where any criticism is denounced as appeasement or being soft on terrorism. In my view, we should simply get beyond this whole question of what's tough on terrorism, what's soft on terrorism. The only thing that matters is what's effective against terrorism. And then thirdly, you tend to enter into a more period that of reflection that I hope that we're entering into now, where we realize, it's clear that our government, I think, has realized that we simply cannot translate our military strength into victory in this battle. We have failed to do so over the past 5 years. Other countries before us have failed to do so. The Russians in Chechnya, Peruvians against Shining Path, Israel against the Palestinians, Britain against the IRA, and so on and so forth. So I think now there's increasing question of how we go about resolving this, and increasing recognition that we need a much more integrated, multifaceted, and less exclusively military response.
We're going to have to stop. The book is What Terrorists Want, Understanding the Enemy, Containing the Threat. Much more we could talk about, but we're out of time. The author, our guest, Louise Richardson, thanks so much for your time.